All right, I'm Stephanie.
And I'm Natalia.
And this is Till Death Do Us Part.
The episode that we're going to do today, I don't know how we both are on the same topic all the time.
Our brains are just connected. I don't know how else to explain it.
Get out of my head.
It's just like we start watching the same kinds of shows at the same time. We start researching the same stuff at the same time. And it's not because we talk about it. It just happens.
It's such a weird parallel. So what did you do? What book did you pick up at Barnes & Noble?
Oh my God. I really should have it in my head. Okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to cut this part out. Just stay right here, because if not, okay. I'm going to feel stupid. Coming back.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm just curious.
No, it's good. No, because it's going to go in perfectly. Randomly, just saw this in Barnes & Noble's the other day. It's called Forensics, What Bugs, Burns, Prints, DNA, and More Tell Us About Crime. By Val McDermid?
Huh.
Yes.
Interesting.
And it's very good. It talks all about how forensics got started. And then it really goes into like modern day forensics, what CSI does now. How it works, even in like the courtroom, like CSI is getting like cross-examined, how they have to hold up in court. They go through like an autopsy from top to bottom.
Uh-huh.
It goes through like decomposition of the human body from top to bottom. It's very thorough.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's good. Okay. It's good.
I'm just going to cut you off because... I'm going to start my story, and then you can tell me if any of this is in your book.
Oh my God, go.
I did not go to Barnes & Noble. I did not go buy a book on forensics. I learned about this, of all places. It sparked on TikTok because they were doing, I guess since the pandemic, they have had like virtual tours of museums.
Okay.
Because people couldn't obviously go anywhere. So they have all these videos where you can like explore exhibits, and it literally can be anything from like King Tut or a pyramid or like just some local historical interesting thing. And so that's what I was like diving deep on, because I thought it was like kind of cool. Like, I'm never going to go to some of these weird places like in New Hampshire. Maybe.
For real.
Who knows? Yeah. And so that's where it started. And of course, the rabbit hole of the internet and TikTok, this is where I ended up. So I will start at the very beginning. And the episode today is on Frances Glessner Lee. And this is just crazy. Okay. So long ago, obviously, it was much easier for criminals to get away and not be caught because there was no such thing as detective schooling. They simply were not trained to do active crime scenes for forensic evidence and an interest in how detectives could examine clues. So all that changed when Frances pioneered and established legal medicine known today as forensic science. And to train homicide detectives, Frances created the Nutshell Studies. They're incredibly detailed dollhouse dioramas of death. So, in the way, way back machine, we're going to Chicago. It's 1878, and Frances was born into a wealthy family in Chicago. She and her brother were homeschooled, and it was at a young age that Frances became interested in sciences. Because when she was a young girl, she got super sick with tonsillitis. At the time, it was a very dangerous treatment option. So her parents sought several opinions for a doctor who could do the surgery safely. So that kind of is when she got interested in working with doctors and nurses. And during summers, her family would travel to the White Mountains in New Hampshire. And this is where local doctors would attend home visits. Like, this is way back in the day. And Frances would go with them, kind of just be a fly on the wall and soak up all the knowledge that she could as a young girl. Like, usually as a kid, don't you want to be like going swimming and like doing fun summer things? Hers was like hanging out with the nurse and going to doctor visits. So
I like it. I know.
So this is where she learned her skills in nursing. And she wanted to go to Harvard Medical like her brother did, because there her whole family was like a Harvard family. But at the time, the university did not accept women. So she, because of her father, they were extremely wealthy. She kind of just lived as a socialite. And right before she turned 20, or she, I don't know if she was 20 or it was right before then, but she married a man named Blewett Lee. That's his name, Blewett.
Wow.
Some old timey name.
That is something.
He was 10 years older than her. And after three children that they had together, Blewett moved out and the two divorced. She even destroyed every single photo of them together. So the divorce may have been a little bitter, I would say.
Wow. Yeah. Sounds like she didn't take that well, huh?
No. She was left raising three kids on her own, but she knew how to make the best of it. It wasn't until her family was older and she had time on her own to pursue her own interests. When Frances was 34, she made a diorama of the Chicago Symphony. Her parents were large supporters socially and financially of the symphony, and her mother was such a huge fan that she said that she wished she could just have the entire symphony play at the Chicago Mansion every day. Apparently, they did have the Chicago Symphony play at their house for like parties, but her mom was like number one stan. So to make that happen, Frances made her first miniature. She literally created the entire symphony in miniature form. All 90 musicians in formal clothing with instruments. And it was her first exercise in the amount of detail that went in. She did the faces, hair, made each musician like have a dollhouse chair and on their music stand. They had the correct score sitting in front of the instrument. So it took her like years to do this, but she presented it for her mother for her birthday. And this is what kind of sparked her using these techniques for later in forensic science. So in 1929, I don't know how it happened, but she was sick in a hospital and recovering. And at the same hospital, I don't know if it was in the same room that they were recovering or same place, but Dr. George McGrath and her, which he actually was her brother's best friend from Harvard, during this extended hospital stay, they got to know each other during this like lengthy recuperation. And they would spend hours talking because he was the medical examiner for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And after he trained in Europe, he came back to the United States and started to instill crime sciences and pathology practices. So this was like the best case scenario for Frances.
Yeah, right? Very fortuitous meeting.
His high profile cases led to his prestige as a crime doctor. And this was just up Frances's alley because she grew up going on doctor's visits and hanging out with the nurses. That was her idea of a summer vacation. She just found it fascinating. And after Dr. McGrath recovered, he went back to Harvard Medical to continue as an instructor. And as one of the few medical examiners in the country, he was interested in creating a department called legal medicine, which is obviously the application of medicine in law and justice. And Frances saw this as an opportunity to help her friend. which of course she's going to use any opportunity she wants to attend Harvard, which she couldn't because she was a woman. So 2 years later, March 1931, Lee approached Lawrence Lowell. He was the president of Harvard University with a proposal to commemorate Dr. McGrath's 25 years as a medical examiner, but she kind of had like some cards up her sleeve. I don't really think she cared about his 25 years. She wanted to do. Yeah, she was smart, but she was like, let's commemorate it with a special project. Because she's independently wealthy from her father, she inherited this massive fortune from the Harvester fortune, which I guess was like farming equipment that they sold back then. So she inherited all this money and had the time and the wealth to pursue her own interests. So she donated the money to create the first legal medicine department in the entire country. So this is a new field of medical practice where students would graduate to be forensic scientists and medical examiners. So the donation came with a clause. This is amazing. So she was like, I will help set up this department, whatever you need, I will do it. But I will be Dr. McGrath's teaching assistant. Like, you can do whatever you want with the money, but I get to be a teacher at Harvard. And nice. The president of the university. Yeah, right? She's like a smart cookie. I like her. And of course they said yes. So in the first year that the department was a working teaching department, they performed 56 autopsies. Within these autopsies, it resulted in 13 changes of criminal status. So 9 were suspected homicide cases that were redefined as an accident or suicide or natural causes. So whoever was accused of murder were let free. So that's a big deal. And then in 4 cases, they were actually homicides that would have been undetected if it weren't for the post-mortem identification, which that's huge for the first school year that it was open. They did all this amazing work.
That is incredible.
So we will get into what happens next. So Dr. McGrath, he unfortunately passed away in December 1938. And Miss Lee was like instrumental in training the new pathologist named Dr. Alan Moritz. So 1939, Dr. Moritz comes on and she continues her tenure at Harvard and she starts conducting these homicide seminars, which some places I heard were like 1 day, 2 days, a week. Regardless, she's holding these seminars, however long they are. But they talk on weapons, ammunition, burns, strangulation, and death by violence and poisoning. Because what happens in the first moments of a crime scene is obviously so important. But back then, police departments and first responders were lucky if their employees had a high school education. So Dr. Moritz and Lee saw this as a real need to educate police officers, because at the time police were doing, you know, they were the first at the murder scene sometimes, and they did things like flip bodies, put their hands in the bullet hole, you know, so these seminars were getting the ball rolling for something even bigger. Police needed to be taught to use their powers of observation without disturbing evidence. But how does one teach observation, right? Like, how do you teach someone to look at a crime scene? So do you remember the Chicago Symphony miniature that I told you about?
Yes.
So unlike photos and film, her thought was to create a real crime scene diorama in 3D for like a prolonged study. So starting in the early 40s, which I think she's like 60 years old now. She's a grandmother. She starts constructing 2 to 3 dioramas a year. So she and this carpenter start creating the nutshell studies of unexplained death. Because the entire purpose of forensics is to convict guilty and clear the innocent and find the truth. In a nutshell. See how it all comes together? These handmade dioramas were training tools in the seminars that she and Harvard hosted. Oh my God, my phone's ringing. Hold, please. The first rule of podcasting should be put your phone on silent.
I mean, sometimes your agent needs to get through. What are you gonna?
That's true. Do?
It is. God, it is what it is.
All right. Where should I leave off? Okay. These handmade dioramas were training tools in the seminars that she and Harvard hosted for the legal medicine department. Everything depicted actually happened and were intentionally ambiguous. So she said that they're not meant to be solved, even though she took an actual crime that what happened. She used the homicide or suicide to train the detectives. So each one of these dioramas cost $3,000 to $6,000, which is a fortune because in today's money, it's $1 million. No, it was $60,000 to $80,000 to create just one of these dioramas. And she was funding this with her own money. And she was doing 2 or 3 a year, which is insane. I don't know if this is true, but they said that it was the equivalent of building an actual house in the 1940s. I don't know. Apparently you could buy a house for like $60,000 back then, but
you could probably build like 3 houses back then.
I know. So to build these scenes, she would make actual like planks of wood, use real hair, write in the miniature books. She used tea and ketchup to make blood. She created many like strips of wallpaper and have the seam be where the seam would be on the actual diorama. She would have her carpenter create mini rocking chairs and then rock it back and forth so it looked like it was just sitting exactly how it would be at a crime scene. Like, I don't know how she did that because I would get frustrated and be like, fuck it, it's good enough.
She was very particular, I guess.
Yes.
OCD there, maybe.
To say the least. So we're going to go over one of these crime scenes because it was an actual event that did happen. And this is how you're supposed to look at the diorama. You're supposed to start on the left. Do you want me to send you the picture first?
Yes.
And tell you? Okay.
Do you want me to tell you that this woman is absolutely in this book?
She is.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, she's super famous, but like I never had heard of her before now. And they didn't go into all of this. They mentioned her very briefly, like 2 paragraphs.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean, they made her out to be a rock star, but they summarized it like very, very quickly. So, I mean, they just said that, you know, she was a pioneer and she was a Chicago heiress, that she founded the Harvard School of Legal Medicine in 1931. They talk about the nutshell studies of unexplained death. All right, here. I finally got your text. Let me open this.
I sent you the picture and I sent you the link just in case.
All right, walk me through this.
Okay, so let me get back to where I was. All right, so how to look at the diorama. You start on the left side and move your eyes kind of like in a spiral. So you circle around, you train yourself to look at everything. You're not supposed to like be judgmental. Just create a hypothesis of what you think happened in your mind. Because literally the smallest like head of a pin can hold information. So the diorama that I sent you is called, it's number 4, and it's called the Parsonage. And here is what actually happened. Monday morning, August 19th, 1946, at about 11 a.m., the young Dorothy Dennison, who's a high school student, walked her way downtown to buy some hamburger steak from the butcher, and she never came back. After being reported missing by her mother, she was found dead in, apparently this is a church rectory. Her blouse was pulled open. A knife was in her stomach. There's a package of rancid hamburger meat in the room. And there are no signs of forced entry or struggle. The windows are shut. Blinds are drawn. There's mail that's accumulated under the mail slot. And her legs are slightly spread. Her dress is pulled up. It doesn't show in the diorama, but her breasts were exposed and also mutilated. There's also a hammer laying next to her body. Mm-hmm. And blood has completely saturated the floor. So we'll look at a few pieces of the evidence in the diorama. So number 1 is the chairs and piano. Obviously, we noticed that because it's covered like no one lives there. Like it's abandoned, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So where is the church rector? Who has the keys to get in here? And is there blood on the piano or the stool? Is it possible that she was sitting and got attacked from behind from the hammer?
I didn't see blood on anything.
Right, exactly. the body, she's not laying in a natural position.
Mm-hmm.
And given the heat and humidity of August, the amount of decomposition will help determine the time of death. There's also, I can't see them, but apparently there are bite marks on her body.
Mm.
Did that happen pre or post-mortem? Because
mm-hmm.
it would depict on the miniature Dorothy.
Okay.
So the hammer. Is there any evidence on the hammer besides human remains? Is there like a toolbox nearby? It will help determine whether the hammer was grabbed for convenience or brought to the scene. So like, mm-hmm. did they just grab it there or did he have the weapon with him?
Did he bring it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or was the hammer the actual cause of death and not the knife in her abdomen?
Mm-hmm.
On the right-hand side, I didn't notice this at first, but I'm also not a detective. Her purse and the package of meat are placed neatly on the chair as if she was not in a hurry to set them down. So, like, in a zoomed-in picture I found on the internet, they are placed perfectly on the chair, like, in orderly. Usually, like, I guess when you have your wallet or whatever, you just kind of toss it on the counter.
Yeah.
They were placed there perfectly even. And the condition of the hamburger steak
should tell us how long it's been sitting there.
Yeah, it should corroborate with the timeline of the witness statements, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a presence of mail accumulating. So no one's currently in the residence, but there's still mail being delivered to this house. So who's the mail addressed to? Like, does that have a clue on it? So here's what actually happened. So all these clues are what the detectives would find because it wasn't put in here because they didn't want you to find like a solution. They wanted you to create a hypothesis and go in with like an open mind, not create any endpoints. They just wanted you to observe. That was the whole purpose of these, but here's what actually happened.
Sure. Okay.
So when Dorothy walked downtown, her mom sent her out to go buy the hamburger steak, but she didn't return for dinner. And she didn't have very much money on her. So after hours of her not coming home, her mom phoned the butcher. And the butcher said, yes, she did come. She did buy the meat, and she left before noon. But since she couldn't find her, she never came home. She was reported missing at 5:25 p.m. And the police took charge right away, which, thank God, they usually are like, wait 24 hours or or whatever.
Right. She ran away.
Yeah, she ran away. But it wasn't until Friday, a few days later, that they entered the parsonage and found Dorothy there. And what they concluded was, even though that the temperatures ranged between 85 and 90 degrees and had high humidity, she was murdered that Monday. And they concluded that the butcher, I don't know if he brought her there or followed her, but he was the one who murdered young Dorothy. So that's just one of the dioramas. There's 18 of these. And that's what I saw on TikTok, but I'll tell you more at the end of it.
Wow.
So the training the police officers received at her seminars prepared them to be more effective at crime scenes, and in recognition of Francis's contribution, New Hampshire State Police Colonel Ralph Caswell named her police captain in 1943. She was the first female police captain ever in the entire country. She was 66 years old at the time, and for the rest of her life, I love this, she addressed herself as Captain Lee.
I love it.
So Captain Lee continued her mission to instruct the public on medical examiners and the importance of the forensics. And she did this by media. She used books like The Case of the Musical Cow and movies like Mystery Street. I never heard of either of these movies or books.
Never heard of it. Nope. But I want to. The Case of the Musical Cow sounds amazing.
It is. Okay. So The Case of the Musical Cow, it was made by the author Earl Stanley Gardner. He was the best-selling author at the time, and he is the creator of the Perry Mason novels.
Yes.
Right? Now we've heard of him. So he was able to wrangle himself in a seat at one of Harvard's seminars, and Captain Lee challenged him. And she was like, what you do, I mean, these are like for professionals. You're just an author. You portray police as fools in your books, and she just did not get along with him. She gave him a run for his money, but Gardner was so impressed with Francis's like orderly and logical mind and how she did these seminars that he ended up dedicating one of his books, The Case of the Dubious Bridegroom, to her, which I've got to read this book.
Wow.
I don't know if it was one of the Perry Mason episodes, but I think that would be amazing.
That's cool.
He spent 2 weeks with Lee, and he learned everything he could. And that's when he wrote The Case of the Musical Cow. MGM was so interested in this untapped genre of true crime coming to life that they wanted to make movies in the true crime genre. They used Francis Lee's teachings within movies. MGM even signed an agreement with Dr. Moritz at Harvard to do the movie Murder at Harvard, I think is what it was called. But Harvard was like, we don't want our name used whatsoever in a movie. So that's when they changed it to Mystery Street. And it's about a police officer who seeks assistance from the Harvard medical staff and uses forensics to solve a murder with like ballistics and photography. It sounds fantastic. And this movie paved the way for shows like Mystery, CE, and CSI, which.
Oh, hello.
Talking about that.
Yes.
And just to wrap it all up, Captain Frances Glessner Lee died in 1962 on short of her 84th birthday. She had numerous honors due to her work, paving the way for medical examiners, coroners, pathologists. She was respected all over the world, and she left behind these 18 nutshell dioramas still exist today, still being used to train police officers and report their findings. And her seminars that she started, you can still attend them. They're being held in Baltimore, Maryland. And she never had any initials after her name. She was never a doctor. She never technically had a job. But she was labeled as this wealthy woman who had nothing to do. But she certainly proved herself to be more than that.
Yes. Amazing.
So that is Frances Lee.
I read that her 18 models are still being used for training purposes.
Yeah.
50 years later at the mm-hmm. Office of Chief Medical Examiner.
Yes.
That's awesome. Amazing.
So I would, I mean, obviously they are showing crime scenes. I know some people don't like looking at crime scene pictures and images like that, but I mean, it is a dollhouse diorama, but mm-hmm. I would want anyone to just go look and appreciate the amount of detail that she did. And every single diorama was a real case that happened in real life. They were all based on true stories, which I think is, I don't know, the amount of effort that went in and the amount of money and detail. She would hire carpenters to make these things. I think it, some of them had like working lights and electricity, like just crazy.
That's incredible. It's just a lot of research, devotion, just, she did a great job.
Yeah, and I was so shocked that I've never heard of, like, this amazing woman in this field who kind of finagled her way in. She made a spot for herself when no women were police captains or teachers. And she was right? Like, nope, I'm fine.
Yeah, she was like, I'm going to take this.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome. I also read that when she made the dioramas and she was training people to look at them, that her whole thing was they only had 90 minutes to study it.
Oh, like, right.
They had 90 minutes to look at it and write their report. Like, that was it.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
That's awesome.
I would be like, I need more time.
Nope. That's it.
I think Done. It would be fascinating to see you go to one of these seminars. If
Amazing.
There's a way, if there's a way that we can like go to Baltimore for a weekend.
Let's do it.
Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be so much fun.
So the whole, how I was finding these stupid TikTok videos. Well, they're not stupid, but it like whoever was making the video, it was literally of a dollhouse. And I was going to like scroll past it because I was like, I could care less. And all of a sudden it was like a dude hanging in the middle of a barn. And I'm like, who's making these dioramas? And then they start speaking how like there's a ton of these and the amount of detail that went in, and apparently they're used for training purposes. And so that's what like sparked my intrigue on this whole topic. So that's how I found out about it. So if you do want to, if you happen to see these videos now, you can appreciate them for what they are, because the videos are 60 seconds long. They don't really show much,
I was saying, at this point, I think my phone's heard me. So now it's going to show me, you know, just because it's going to.
Yeah. Isn't that how it always happens? I wonder if that's what's happening to us when you're at Barnes & Noble and I'm on TikTok.
Maybe.
The algorithm knows.
It's putting books on the shelf for me. That's crazy.
That's so fantastic. Well, thank you for putting up with me.
Oh my God, no, that's awesome. I loved it. I got to tell you, I'm loving this book. You can tell that I'm going to send you a snapshot. We can put it on Insta. You know that a true crime fanatic is reading this book because I have so many sticky notes sticking out of this book marked with just decomposition, strangulation.
That was amazing.
Wicked little post-it notes. If I left this out, somebody would think I'm just something's really wrong with me. And there is.
There is something wrong with us.
Oh, it's so good. And I'm just constantly amazed by how much I don't know in true crime and how much I still have to learn. And I love it.
Me too.
There's just so much to learn about how they read these clues in crime scenes where there's been fires, where there's been like decomposition, and they study the bugs, a poisoning. So one of the things I didn't know that when you have a body that is suspected of arsenic poisoning, they now realize that they have to test the soil around the body.
Really?
Yes, because arsenic can be in the soil.
No, I did not know that.
Yes, so you can't just assume that that person was poisoned because maybe they've absorbed it from the soil.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it may not be an issue if, you know, they've been sealed in something that the soil couldn't get to them.
True.
However, they now have to test the parameters around that body because the soil can hold arsenic at like certain levels that could contaminate the body.
Oh my God. Who knew? Don't play in dirt. Jesus, there's tetanus and arsenic in there now.
Oh my God. So listen, this is not going to have any patient identifier, so nobody can come after me. But I had a patient that I had to call today. He was in the ER because he was gardening, did not know what the fuck he was doing.
Uh-oh.
Was gardening with a plant, and it's a beautiful plant. I have it in my garden, but I know better. I know to wear gloves. The plant is called foxglove. It's beautiful. However, it is also digitalis. And if you touch it, it can stop your heart. And actually, digitalis, we extract it and actually use it in medication for patients. It's an actual medicine. So, yeah, he was just gardening without gloves, and he ended up in the ER. It was insane. I haven't seen something like that ever.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was something like we've always heard of it, like, ooh, don't touch the flowers. But this was like a legit patient that actually I saw in the ER.
Holy shit.
With a real problem. And I was like, oh shit, it actually happens.
It does. It does actually happen.
Yeah.
My dream, I watched something on Hulu, and it was, I can't even tell you the story, but I stopped it and I told Josh that my dream, because he's going into the career of fire investigation and things like that. And so I said, if there's ever like a murder, you have to let me know.
Because absolutely.
Some of that stuff, when they do the fire investigation, they're like, no, there was an accelerant. It started here and it did this and this and this. Like all the stuff that they can tell from the crime scene after a fire is crazy.
Insane. There's an entire chapter in here just on the crime scene investigations after a fire. It's incredible.
It's so incredible. Cool. It's the fires really don't burn hot enough. Like a body wouldn't disappear or disintegrate. Like
not
all this
just
stuff.
That.
It's just so cool.
In the chapter, they were talking about how when they go in after a fire, depending on how the fire burned, how, if there was an accelerant, how it was spread, mm-hmm. how a fire sometimes will leave a lot of things intact. They said, you know, sometimes you'll walk through and some things will be completely charred, but you'll find like a TV remote. Like only the top is melted, but like the bottom of it is completely preserved and you can still get fingerprints from the bottom of it. Like you never know what a fire will pass over.
Yeah.
Because of the way fire moves and what is damp and where it's attracted to with the oxygen and the mm-hmm. wind flow. And just, there's so many variables with fire. It's just, it's wild. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think it's so fascinating. Just the way that houses are made now, I guess they just kind of go up in flames, but all the items like inside your house will be perfectly, well, not perfectly fine, but like your TV will still be there and like your bed
right.
will still be there and all your clothes, because everything's like flame retardant.
Yes, a lot of things are going to survive the fire, including a lot of your body.
Yeah.
Oh, so I remember we were talking about how would they know that body wasn't Belle's body last week?
Yeah.
So they talked about how they can tell because of the fire damage to a body, how quickly they have an algorithm for how quickly fat melts off of a body. Yeah. So like,
I mean,
they can
I would
tell,
imagine
like,
so.
Like depending on how long that fire has burned, they know how thick you were.
How thick you were?
I mean, I gotta put it that way. Like they can tell.
Because of the adipose. Oh my God. Do you know what would be so fun? This is really weird.
I don't know. After that sentence, do you know what would be really fun after burning bodies? What?
Something is so wrong with me. Okay. That I think it's in Tennessee. There's a body farm and it's at one of the colleges where they do forensics and they have different like pigs or bodies at all sorts.
Yes.
Sort like states of decomposition.
Yes. Yes, I mean, they have it. They write about it in the book. Yes, there is.
Oh my God.
And you can go tour it. Yes.
Oh, yes. I want to do a tour.
Let's do it. Let's go. Let's just do a road trip. We'll go hit the dioramas.
Sure.
We'll go to the body farm. Just go to all of them.
All the places.
All the places. Like a Murderino's road trip.
Oh, we should totally do a Murderino road trip. And then we can end it in Salem.
Awesome. I'm down.
I'm down.
Start planning that now.
We should. This is our summer vacation.
I love it. This is perfect.
My gosh. Hey, everyone. I wanted to jump on here real quick and let everyone know how they can get a hold of us. Of course, we are on all social media channels. We are on TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If you want to send us a message, tilldeathdoaspartpodcast@gmail.com. And we're much more active on Instagram, tilldeathdoaspartpodcast. If you have sent us a message and we haven't either responded or heard back from us, do not feel bad. It is not your fault. It's Natalia's fault. And with that being said, definitely like, follow, subscribe, review, share, all those fun things. See you later.